Let's get going on another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. We're going to open to Deuteronomy chapter number 21, and we're going to start at verse number 22. Remember that Deuteronomy is the final address of Moses to the people of Israel shortly before his death, shortly before they go into the promised land. And he is trying to cram in a whole bunch of review material for them on how they need to live their lives once they arrive in the promised land. So we have a mixture of things that he's talking about here. It shifts from one thing to another pretty quickly. We had just talked about the execution of a really bad juvenile delinquent. Probably an older minor. Remember, you didn't come to majority age till your 20th birthday in the ancient Israeli culture. So if you got a really bad older juvenile delinquent that just won't quit hurting people and doing bad things and is a danger to the society, that he needs to be executed. And that execution was by stoning. The next thing that happens after an execution by stoning is to hang the body of the criminal on a tree. This is actually a very ancient, widespread practice that becomes the start of crucifixion. The idea was, displaying the body of someone who was just killed for their crime might chill the possibility of others engaging in that same crime. Now, in a lot of the societies, they just left the body displayed that way, either on a natural tree or perhaps on a stylized tree, what we would call a post or a cross. They'd leave it there until it started rotting. And that kind of, in those societies, added to the scariness of doing a capital crime. The Israelis were expected by God to have more respect for the humanity of the person. Even a criminal started out in the image of God. And so Deuteronomy 21:22 says, if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he is put to death, so you stone him to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day. For a hanged man is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land with that he who is your God is giving you for an inheritance. So for the Israelis, the capital punishment was there, but and this, so was the displaying of the dead body of the criminal. But the body had to be buried by the time the sun went down. That was all the time necessary for the warning to anybody else engaging in the same type of practice. Now, this is an interesting passage for a couple of things. Number one, this helps us understand why the Jewish people requested of Pilate that the bodies be removed. Now, the text says that they were asking Pilate to remove the crucified men because the next day was a high Sabbath day. It was actually the Sabbath that falls during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But from this text, it would just be normal practice for the Jewish people to not want criminals hanging on crosses for more than the one day. And so they sped up the execution. And Jesus was already dead, so they didn't need to do that for him. But the more important tie-in to the New Testament is found in Paul's letter to the Galatians, where he is talking about being justified by faith rather than by the law. And so breaking into the context in verse number 10 of chapter 3 in Galatians, Paul writes, "For all who rely on works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed be everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law and do them." That's actually a quote from chapter 27 in the book of Deuteronomy. We haven't got there yet. Now, it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law. For it says, quote, "The righteous shall live by faith." So a righteous person stays alive by not getting in trouble with the law. That's the Old Testament way of doing things. But in the New Testament, the righteous person stays in right relationship by God by trusting that God will take care of the problem that separated them from God. So, verse 12, here's his point. The law is not of faith. Rather, quote, "The one who does them shall live by them." So that's the one I was just alluding to, Leviticus 18:5. In the Old Testament way of doing things, if you did a capital crime, you got executed. If you wanted to live, you behaved yourself and followed the law. In the New Testament, we know that all of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All of us have been separated from God's righteousness because of our sin. And so the only way to get back into relationship with Him is by our faith. The righteous person shall live by their faith. They shall be made alive by their faith. Now, not to drag it out anymore, here's what he says next. Verse 13, "Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, for it is written, quote, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree,' end quote, so that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith." So Paul's point is, using this passage from Deuteronomy 21, that Jesus Christ voluntarily took our capital punishment, and we're talking about spiritual capital punishment here, separation from God, upon himself, voluntarily went to the cross, died, he was hung on the tree, and became the curse for us, so that we might live by faith. Now, of course, he resurrected, so he did not stay under that curse. And so that is one of the things that we are praising the Lord for, is that, yes, Jesus did take the curse of God upon himself, but in so doing, he gained victory over sin and death in the grave, and now brings all of us that have trusted him into right relationship with the eternal Father for the eternal kingdom. So one of the great applications of the Old Testament to the New Testament. Now, back to the Deuteronomy passage, chapter 22. Shift in topic, and this is one that we've seen before in Exodus. "You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and ignore them." So if you see one of your neighbor's material belongings, as in one of his cattle, wandering around, not where it belongs, you don't just ignore it. "You shall take them back to your brother." So you try to get them back with the person they belong to. "Now, if he does not live near you, and you don't know who he is," so perhaps, you know, you see these animals wandering and you don't recognize them. I don't know if they did some sort of, not branding, but some sort of marking system to show which animals belong to which farmers. But there was sometimes that you didn't recognize the animal. And so the law that Moses gave them was, if you don't know who it belongs to, you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall stay with you until your brother seeks it. So you take it home and take good care of it. It's not a finder's keeper's thing. It's a finder's wait to see if the loser comes around looking for it. And then you shall restore it to him. Make sure he gets it back to him. Now, it used to be when you found lost property that you would take it down to the police station, I think, and sometimes you'd put a notice in the paper saying this was found, come and identify it, things of that nature. And then after a period of time, if nobody claimed it, it belonged to you. But the whole point in all of that was to try to find who it really belonged to. Because this is a golden rule situation. You should do unto others as you would have them do unto you. As I record this, it's only been about a week since my wallet went missing. It wasn't stolen. I lost it somewhere. I know exactly where I was at the last time I used it, and the only place I went to after that was home. So it was lost somewhere, and somebody must have found it, but they didn't return it to me. My address and everything was inside of it, and they shouldn't have, and contact information, they should not have had a problem to get in touch with me. But they didn't. So they did not do what I would have done for them. And I know I would have done it for him because I've done it on a couple of occasions where I found lost wallets and got them back to their owners intact. So this is the same thing. You think about other people the way you want to be thought of. And if you lose a pet, more in our context, or a piece of property, you'd want it returned. So if you find something like that, do your best to get it back to them. Verse 3, you shall do the same with his donkey or with his garment or with any lost thing of your brother's which he loses and you find. You may not ignore it. See, that's not right. It's not fair. In the other passages where this is mentioned, it's even attached to the idea of it doesn't matter if you even get along with them. They might be your, quote, enemy, end quote. Somebody that has treated you wrong in the past. Doesn't matter. Your responsibility, my responsibility as a fellow human being, is to help the other person out, just like we'd want to be helped out. Verse 4, you shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and ignore them. You shall help him to lift them up again. So donkeys and oxen were used to move things from point A to point B. And sometimes they'd have trouble and they might get down. Maybe they run off the road and get bogged down in the mud. Well, if you happen to be going by and you see that going on, you do what you can to help. Doesn't even matter if they've been an enemy of yours in the past. They're a human being in need of assistance. In our modern day context, this is the reason sometimes we stop and help people get their tires changed when they're flat, or maybe we help push them, you know, out of the intersection when their car has stalled, or help them get out of a snowbank. Last winter, I was at Meijer on Grape Road, and my poor little car's tires got stuck in some of those little divots that we all know are in the parking lot there. And it was icy, and my front wheel drive could not break free. And so I said, hey, somebody, help me. And I had several people come and help push me out of the little divot. And I thanked them profusely because they did for me exactly what I needed. And I would have done the same thing for them. And so that's the lesson here, Old Testament, New Testament. We're in this world together. We're all human beings, and we should be looking out for each other. Verse number 5, change of topic. A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak, for whoever does these things is an abomination to he who is your God. Now, the contextual meaning of this has to do with being a transvestite. That is, identifying with the other gender. That is problematic because God did create us as a bi-gender group, male and female. And when you feel confused and want to identify with the other side of that equation, that is a problem. And sometimes this presents itself in wanting to dress like the other gender. And so that's what it's talking about here. Now, what is it not talking about? Something that happened when I was a kid. And that was, at that time in American culture, particularly in more rural American culture, because I lived in the southern part of Missouri at the time, women always wore dresses and skirts, never pants. And when it started becoming fashionable for women to wear pants, some churches had an absolute fit about that, and they quoted this passage. That is not what we were talking about here. That is not the context of transvestitism. That's just simply a new style of clothing being adopted for a gender's purposes. I can even show you this as an example from the first century culture. In the first century culture, men and women alike wore what was effectively a dress. It was a robe. But each of them had a robe style that was clearly intended for their gender. And so that was what this passage has to do with. Verse number 6, change of topic. If you come across a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs, and the mother is sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you and that you may live long. This is a form of conservation, animal conservation. You don't hunt your animals into extinction. You don't overuse the animal resources. And the same could be said about the resources of vegetation and plants and trees and things as well. Because you need to have it for the future as well. So you only take what you need, and you make sure that it can keep on reproducing. There's also an element here of kindness that I've mentioned before. If you're looking to get some eggs from the wild birds, there's no reason to eat the mom as well. That just seems unfair. If you're planning on making a little pie out of some young squab, don't take the mom as well. That's just a little bit cold-hearted, and we don't need to be cold-hearted. So conservation, though, seems to be its major point in this passage. Verse number 8, change of topic. When you build a new house, now remember that the Israelis, as they're going into the promised land, they're going into a turnkey situation. So the houses that exist there, the Canaanites built. And so the Israelis are now going to take over most of those properties as their places of residence. But here is the reminder to them for whenever they get ready to build their own house. When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof. Now, the roofs that they had, and you still see this in the Middle East quite a bit, are flat. And they get used as a patio. It's just a patio on top of the house. It's the decking area. So people spend time up on the roof where it's cooler, where the wind blows more freely across. They'll even make a little lean-to up there in order to spend time up on the top of their house just relaxing. Well, the rule was make sure you put a safety parapet all the way around it so that you will not bring the guilt of blood upon your house if anyone should fall from it. So this is a safety procedure. This is what we'd refer to today as code enforcement. Everybody needs to take the reasonable steps to prevent accidents. And top of the house, you need to make sure nobody that kind of stumbles might accidentally go over the edge. Instead, they'd come up against this railing, against this parapet. Now, my assumption is that based on this law, any Canaanite houses that were not up to code, shall we say, were fixed, and these issues were taken care of. Verse number 9, change of topic. You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, lest the whole yield be forfeited, the crop that you've sown and the yield of the vineyard. Now, the phrasing at the beginning of this is a little bit confusing, I think, because it almost feels like you're sowing two types of grain into the vineyard that already exists. But that doesn't seem to be what the second half of the verse is indicating. The one crop is the seed for the grain, and the second crop is the vineyard crop that's already there, which presumably you had planted yourself. So this actually goes back to something that we saw before, and not surprising because Moses is reviewing a lot of laws from earlier. It's from Leviticus 19:19, that you're not supposed to mix up things that are different in the same area. So sheep and goats, excuse me, try that again. So we don't keep cows and sheep together in the same field. We don't have the barley and the wheat planted in the same field. There is a segregation, a distinction made between these different things. This was another one of the lessons being taught from God to the Israeli people in, you know, some sort of metaphorical form, that you don't try to mix holy people with unholy people. When God says there needs to be a distinction, you keep the distinction. There was nothing intrinsically wrong with putting barley, for example, between the rows of your vineyard, but God says just don't do it. And that was enough of a reason for them not to do it. Verse 10, same thing. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Now, that's actually pretty pragmatic because they're not the same body type, and they are going to make the furrow look kind of weird because they won't be pulling equally, and it'll be zigzaggy. And you're also going to wear your animals out because one of them will be pulling harder against the other. I've actually seen a picture from the 1800s of somebody trying to plow a field in the Middle East with a camel and a donkey. And it was clear that the poor donkey was having a hard time of it, trying to keep up with the much taller and apparently stronger camel. So don't do it. If God says don't do these things together, don't do them together. And that was the lesson about holy and unholy. Verse 11, same lesson. You shall not wear cloth of wool and linen mixed together. Wool is an animal source fiber. Linen is a plant source fiber. So they are distinct from one another. And God says, don't use them together in the same garment. Keep them holy from one another, separated from one another. Nothing intrinsically wrong with it. As far as I know, if you had a wool-linen blend, it wouldn't blow up on you or anything like that. It wouldn't cause you to break out in hives or die of some sort of disease. But it was the lesson to help the Israeli people understand when God tells you, do it this way, not that way, you follow his instructions. Remember my example of basic military training. They had us do all sorts of nitpicky things to teach us how to follow orders and to keep attentive to detail. Once we were done with basic military training and had learned those lessons, we weren't expected to do the nitpicky things ever again. Lesson learned. And so that seems to be what some of these things in the Old Testament were for. We'll finish off with another garment-related thing. Verse 12, you shall make yourselves tassels on the four corners of the garment with which you cover yourself. These were like little thick, twisted strings at the corners of the outermost layer of the clothing. The idea seems to have been that as they flipped around and with your movement throughout the day, it would catch your eye and it would be a reminder based on the other passage where this is found, Numbers 15:38. It would be a reminder to you that you belonged to the covenant. Keep holy as God is holy. Do things his way. We have an ancient example of this on a wall painting in Egypt that seems to be a Jewish person with these little tassels down on the corners of their kilt that they wore in Egypt at the time. But when we come back next time, I'll talk a little bit about the New Testament tie-in.